The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 10.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. I'm going to be doing this one solo. I've been saying for a long time now that what the Fed started doing right as the crisis hit back in the fall of 2008 was that the Fed started paying commercial banks to not make loans to their customers. And I say that, of course, to be somewhat provocative. That certainly wakes people up when I'm talking to a regular crowd, gets their attention. And so I thought, why don't I take this episode of the Bob Murphy Show to just explain step by step exactly what do I mean by that? Because I think you'll agree, if what I'm saying is true, and I'm going to argue that it is true, that's why I'm saying it, that that's pretty significant, right? Because remember, just to remember the context, back in the fall of 2008, you know, there was the crisis, Lehman goes down, they bail out AIG, the credit markets are all seizing up. Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary at the time, former head of Goldman Sachs, is literally getting down on his knee and begging Nancy Pelosi for TARP funds, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, because otherwise, you know, ATMs are going to stop working, right? That was the myth being peddled. And by my language there, you can tell I don't endorse it. And by the way, just as a brief aside, David Stockman's book, The Great Deformation, in addition to having all sorts of other goodies in there, I think he gave the best breakdown or takedown, I should say, of that narrative, right? The idea that, oh, if the Fed and the U.S. federal government hadn't intervened aggressively in the fall of 2008, then normal people's life insurance policies would have been unfunded and you would have gone to the ATM and put in your debit card and oops, no money would have come out. That was largely scare tactics to get the public to go along with bailing out the big investment banks and so forth. And I think David Stockman does a good job in that book of explaining that. But back to my purpose in this particular episode, just as they were justifying all of these bailouts of large financial institutions, claiming that the financial sector is going to implode if we don't act quickly, that was also when this new program that I'm going to explain to you in this episode began. Right, so specifically, it was in October of 2008. So the crisis really struck in September. And then it was the next month in October when the Fed began this new program of what's called paying interest on reserves. So it's somewhat technical, but it's not that bad. And like I say, stick with me because I really want you to understand exactly what they're doing. Just to give you the punchline, with the latest Fed announcement, so I'm recording this now just as the Fed has had its December 2018 meeting in which they raised interest rates as expected. So at this point, the Fed is paying interest on both excess and reserve or required reserve balances at an annualized rate of 2.4%. And so what that means is right now the Fed is on an annual basis paying commercial banks $40.8 billion per year. Okay. And as they continue to raise that interest rate, the number goes up if the Fed doesn't keep selling off assets. Okay. So that's, you know, just to say that right now there's a sense in which the commercial banks are getting just shy of $41 billion in an annual rate from the Federal Reserve as a direct payment. If they tried to justify that in a vacuum and just come out and said, that's what we're doing, people would be rioting. But that wasn't how the program was sold. And I think most of the public probably isn't really aware of it because this stuff with central banking and reserve balances and all that stuff, it just makes your eyes glaze over. I've taught economics classes to undergrads, and I've tried to explain open market operations. Believe me, I know this stuff gets tricky. That's why it was so amazing that Ron Paul gets crowds chanting, end the Fed. I couldn't believe you get anybody excited about monetary policy. So anyway, that's what I want to explain to you guys in this episode, just so you can see the mechanics of it. We don't need to belabor it too long, but I think it is important for you to see how this thing unfolded historically, but also for you to understand exactly what's going on, because it really is shocking what they're getting away with, especially, like I say, not only is it a huge subsidy to the bankers, which the public, if they fully grasped, I think would be outraged by, but also it directly contradicted the whole spirit of what they were talking about in the fall of 2008. That they were, you know, they had slogans like, oh, we have to rescue Wall Street, or we have to bail out Wall Street in order to rescue Main Street. They were saying stuff like that. In other words, if we don't inject liquidity or whatever the euphemisms they want to give, then the credit markets will totally seize up and banks will stop making loans. And hey, small business, you know, they were trotting out percentages about how many small businesses make their payroll using short-term credit. And at the time, I remember a lot of people were like, what? What kind of small business has to, you know, borrow money just to make payroll each month? That's not a very healthy business. But in any event, that was how it was justified. Like, yeah, you know, we really hate bailing out rich bankers, but we got to do it because really we can't sleep at night worrying about the common man. Okay, so there's lots of things that were wrong with that narrative. Some people took the route of saying, well, wait a minute. The amount that the Fed used to sop up mortgage-backed securities, what if they just went and started making whole those homeowners who were underwater on their mortgages? And depending on the calculation and how you do that, arguably they could have, with the same amount of money, just gone out and rescued a lot of the individual homeowners who were behind in their mortgage. And hence that would have plugged the gap and made those mortgage-backed securities not so toxic after all. But in any event, let's put all that stuff aside. For this episode, let's not bite off more than we can chew. I just want to focus narrowly from this point forward on this issue of the Fed's decision in October of 2008 to start paying interest on reserves. So the first thing we need to do is just explain very briefly what happens when the Federal Reserve buys or sells assets and what our reserve balance is. So in modern times, obviously the stuff I'm talking about now, folks, is after the U.S. abandons the gold standard. So this is all based on just fiat dollars. So let's say the Federal Reserve decides to go out in the markets and it buys $10 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. Okay, those are just bonds. Or we could even just say treasury debt, if that's easier, so we don't have to worry about what's a mortgage-backed security in case you don't know. All right, so treasury debt, right? The U.S. government borrows money from somebody in the private sector. So the U.S. government, the treasury, creates a note, you know, a security that says the bearer of this piece of paper, the U.S. government owes whatever, a certain amount of money 10 years from now. Okay, so now there's people out there in the private sector who have lent money to the treasury and they're holding these securities, the, you know, these legally binding instruments that say the owner of this thing is owed money by the treasury when it comes due. Okay, so now the Fed is going to enter the market, the secondary market, not directly lend money to the U.S. government, but instead it's going to buy these treasury securities that the people in the private sector got when they were the ones who directly lent money to the federal government. Okay, so by the way, just a bit of nomenclature, it's common in these discussions to, when you say the federal government, that that's a distinct entity from the Federal Reserve, the central bank. And like legally speaking, that's technically correct. Like strictly speaking, the Federal Reserve is owned by private shareholders. Now, some people make a lot of that. Some people think it's not a big deal. Here, I'm not taking a stand on whether that's a particularly significant fact of the world. But just so you know, in terms of the organization, the legal structure, the Federal Reserve is not like, say, the IRS or the Environmental Protection Agency. Those things are direct agencies of the federal government. The Fed technically is not. The Fed is actually legally owned by private shareholders. Okay, like I said, some people understandably think, whoa, are you kidding me? And they make a big deal of that. But for our purposes now, I'm just explaining that's why I'm going to say the federal government, by which I mean, you know, the entity with Congress and the president and the Supreme Court and all that, that the Treasury is the financing arm of that. And they have the IRS to raise revenues and da, da, da. But the federal government, the way the system is right now, doesn't create money, they defer, you know, the Federal Reserve is the one that does that in terms of buying assets and creating legally valid U.S. dollars electronically. Okay. So don't be confused. If I say Fed, I mean Federal Reserve. Okay. So back to the discussion. So the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, if it wants to buy $10 billion worth of treasury securities, you know, outstanding treasury debt, then it effectively writes a check drawn on the Fed, the Federal Reserve, for $10 billion. It's not buying it from one guy, Jim, who is really rich. It's, you know, buying it from a lot of people probably. But for simplicity's sake, let's just say it's one person or one corporation that has $10 billion of treasury debt. The Fed wants to own that debt. So that to buy something that's $10 billion, you have to write a check for $10 billion. And the Fed does that. And who's paying for it? You know, so it's made out to whatever. The Acme hedge fund owns $10 billion of treasury securities. The Fed comes along and writes a $10 billion check to the Acme fund. And it's drawn on the Federal Reserve Bank. Okay, so now Acme gets the check and it deposits it in its own commercial bank, right? Acme has a checking account, just like lots of businesses do. And so now that commercial bank in turn presents the check to the Fed, and the Fed says, ah, yes, and it credits that commercial bank's account. So the commercial bank, in a sense, has a checking account with the Federal Reserve Bank, if that makes sense, right? So let's say it's like Citibank or something. So Citibank itself, just like you have a checking account balance with Citibank, well, Citibank in turn has a checking account with the Fed. So when we talk about reserve balances, let me explain what that is, because that's necessary for this discussion too. So I'm changing the scenario a little bit just to explain this point, and then we're going to come back to the issue of buying $10 billion worth of treasuries. So your relationship with Citibank, let's say, if you go up to Citibank and you deposit $1,000 in actual currency, right, green pieces of paper, you got your Benjamins or whatever, you're out there hustling on the street making money, you go ahead and you deposit your Benjamins with Citibank, so they credit your checking account with $1,000, right? If you go to an ATM and you know, put in your card, type in your PIN, you look and see what's my balance, it's now showing $1,000 more in there than it was before you made that deposit. So now Citibank takes that $1,000 in cash and puts it in the drawer, or, you know, puts it in the vault, whatever. So those count as reserves. Now, at any given time, there are what's called reserve or required reserve balances as a regulation binding on the commercial banks. So here I'm going to be very loose, folks, just to get the idea across. The idea is for all the outstanding checking account balances that Citibank has among its customers, Citibank has to have 10% of that at least in reserve, right? So that if people showed up all of a sudden and said, hey, I want to take out my money, I want to withdraw the money that you say I have in my checking account with you, they've got a bunch of that, like literally in the vault in the form of cash, you know, green pieces of paper, they could pay the person. And like I say, the required reserve ratio is saying what percentage does that have to be? And it's a minimum, obviously. The Citibank's allowed to have more, but they have to have at least that much, at least if they're going to be in compliance with the required, legally required reserve ratio. Okay. So another quirk here is it's not merely that Citibank needs green pieces of paper on location, you know, in the vault or whatever, to count towards the reserve, required reserve balance. It can also have a checking account or electronic reserves, if you will, on deposit with the Fed. Okay, so let's say Citibank's customers collectively have whatever, $100 billion in checking account balances, right? So if you looked at all the Citibank customers who have a checking account and you added up all those customers, their balance, you know, some guy has $84 in there, another business has $213,000. Somebody else just had a graduation party. They got $346 in there. Blah, 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 blah. You go through, you add up all the Citibank customers and all their checking account balances. And let's say that number totals $100 billion. So in terms of the standard legally required reserve ratio, that means Citibank needs to have in reserve at least $10 billion, right? Because 10% of $100 billion. And so maybe they have $8 billion in actual currency, you know, in the vault, in the drawers or whatever that the tellers have. And so that where's the other $2 billion? Well, what if Citibank itself has $2 billion in its own checking account with the Fed? So my point is that $2 billion doesn't actually exist as green pieces of paper. It's just Citibank is good for it because they can say, hey, in our current legal framework, ever since the U.S. left the gold standard, to have a guaranteed deposit balance with the Fed is the same thing as having green pieces of paper, because the Fed has the legal ability. Like, let's say Citibank says to the Fed, you know what? We need that $2 billion that you say we have on deposit with you, so we'd like to withdraw it, please. The Fed is allowed to just tell the Treasury, like it's the Bureau of Printing and Engraving or something, is just allowed to tell them, print that up. Okay, so like they literally can print it up if need be. Okay, whereas Citibank does not have the legal authority to do it. If you go into Citibank, if a bunch of Citibank's customers showed up and said, we want our money, and Citibank looks in the vaults and says, oh, geez, shoot, we're short. We don't have enough. They can't just say to Jim down the hall, hey, start cranking up that printing press and create $100 bills to pay. That would be counterfeiting. Citibank cannot legally do that. The Fed, in conjunction with the U.S. government, does have the legal ability to do that. But they're not going to do it for anybody. It's just you have to have an account with the Fed and you have to have, you know, reserve balances, right? And so if somebody says, well, we need to withdraw that in the form of physical currency, if the Fed doesn't have it, they can just say, okay, print up more of it. Okay, so that's how that works. So now back to our original example. When the Fed decides, for whatever reason, it wants to enter the market and just buy some assets out there, let's say that they're treasury securities, treasury debt, it writes a check on itself, and now the bank that deposits that gets an extra, in our example, $10 billion credited to its own checking account with the Fed. Okay? So the available reserve balances in the system now just went up by $10 billion, and this is critical. So in a normal thing, like if just hedge fund A buys $10 billion worth of assets from hedge fund B, and hedge fund A writes a check for $10 billion and gives it to hedge fund B. Hedge fund B deposits it as an account, and so hedge fund B's checking account balance with its bank, let's say it's Bank of America, goes up by $10 billion. Bank of America maybe deposits it with the Fed, and then so its Bank of America's checking account balance with the Fed goes up by $10 billion. So you might say, oh, so the reserves in the system just went up by $10 billion. Well, no, because look at the flip side. Hedge fund A was the one that wrote a check on its own account. And so maybe hedge fund A banks with Citibank. And so now through the clearinghouse operations, when the dust settles, Citibank debits hedge fund A's checking account with them by $10 billion. And then also Citibank's reserve balance with the Fed, you know, its checking account balance with the Fed goes down by $10 billion. Okay. So notice the two commercial banks there, Citibank and Bank of America, they don't care about that. They're fine. You know, one customer wrote a check for $10 billion, and so that particular bank, it's, you know, what it said its customer held with it went down by $10 billion, but then, and so that's a liability that went down. But then that bank's asset with the Fed also went down. So that bank just treads water. And so all that really happened there, and on the other side, the other bank, its assets and liabilities went up by the same amount. Okay, so all that really happened there is the reserve balances were transferred from Citibank to Bank of America, if I'm getting my banks right. I think that's the order I said, right? It's just $10 billion got transferred. So there, when the dust settles, when one person in the private sector writes a check to another person in the private sector, the reserve balances end up just moving around, assuming, you know, the customers keep the money in the bank and they don't like pull it out in the form of cash. Okay. So people writing checks in the normal everyday transactions of the private sector, that doesn't cause total reserve balances to bounce around. What I'm saying though is if the Federal Reserve enters the market as a buyer of assets and writes checks on itself, that does increase the total reserve balances in society because the banks who ultimately get those checks to be deposited. It's not that the Fed necessarily is buying it from a bank, but it buys it from somebody who then deposits it into his or her bank account. So that's why the banks are the ultimate institutions getting these deposits. So the bank that ends up depositing that thing, that check that's written on the Fed, gets credited. And so its reserve balances with the Fed go up. But there's no offsetting debit anywhere because it's not that somebody else in the system wrote a check. The Fed itself wrote a check. And the Fed doesn't need to have money saved up in order to buy things. The Fed just creates money. This is where when people say create money out of thin air, this is what they're talking about. It's a bookkeeping accounting operation. And when you really understand what's going on, there is a genuine sense in which the Fed literally creates new dollars in order to then use them to go buy assets. So back in the days of the gold standard, there was a constraint that if they were too reckless in doing this, people could ultimately turn in the dollars and get gold. And if the Fed got caught unable to redeem in terms of gold, then that would look really bad. But right now, there's nothing stopping it except its own discretion, you know, and not wanting to get people too mad at it if prices rise too much. Okay, so that's how it works. And so this is what was happening back in the fall of 2008, was that because of the housing crisis and other events that were happening, people started defaulting on their mortgages. And also just as house prices fell, even somebody who could have afforded to keep making the mortgage payments might have just stopped. And so this is crazy. You know, I bought this house when it was for $400,000 when I thought it was going to keep going up. And now it's down to $270,000. I'm not going to keep making these crazy monthly payments on a house right now that I owe more than it's worth. That's stupid. I'll just walk away. Okay, so there was also like what was called strategic defaults. A lot of people just stopped paying, not out of hardship, but because I don't want to keep pumping money into this asset now that's worth less than the debt I own. Or forget that, I'll just walk away. Okay, so for various reasons, people were defaulting on their mortgages, and that made people worried about these so-called mortgage-backed securities, which were complex financial instruments that basically all these different streams of mortgage payments would flow into, and then they were sliced and diced. And different investors had different like rights in terms of priority. Like, oh, it's like imagine a bucket filling up with mortgage payments from thousands of different mortgage holders. And then depending on how much you paid to get into that thing, you either had a slice of the bucket near the bottom or near the top. So as the bucket's filling up, the slices near the bottom are going to get paid first. But those would be the most expensive to get into because they're not very risky. Whereas the slices near the top of the bucket, only if just about everybody makes their mortgage payment is the bucket going to get up that high. But then that meant you didn't have to pay that much to get in. So it was a riskier thing that, you know, had a higher chance of a rate of return, assuming it paid off. But in any event, because people didn't forecast the housing collapse correctly, or a lot of people didn't, all of a sudden these mortgage-backed securities became very dubious assets. And it set in motion a chain of events that people who had issued things that were like, they're called credit default swaps, that were like insurance against those things. Then those parties were now all of a sudden in trouble because it wasn't clear how much are they going to have to pay. So all these things started cascading in the fall of 2008. And so what happened was the Fed comes in and starts, quote, injecting liquidity. And so what they were doing was lending money to institutions, and also they started buying assets to try to prop up their price. So the Fed started buying mortgage-backed securities, or they would give loans to institutions that would then buy these mortgage-backed securities. And so the idea was to prop up the price to prevent, you know, a chain reaction that, oh, geez, if these assets fall in price, then all of a sudden that makes a bunch of other firms in trouble. So they got to sell off some of their assets to raise money. And then it just causes this, you know, fire sale and a chain reaction and a downward plunge. That's the idea. So they wanted to nip that in the bud. So the Fed comes and starts buying these so-called toxic assets and, you know, lending money for other institutions to prop up their price. So what was happening there is they're creating a bunch more reserves in the system. So now normally in terms of textbook, how do you explain to an undergraduate macroeconomics class, how does the Fed raise or lower interest rates? The normal textbook story, certainly the one that was taught before the 2008 crisis, said, oh, if the Fed wants to push down interest rates, they buy assets that creates new money, new reserves that then flood the financial sector. And now because banks have more reserves, they're allowed to lend more money to their clients, right? Because remember, the reserve ratio, the legally required reserve ratio says you look and see how many checking account balances do your customers collectively hold, and then you have to have at least 10% or whatever the percentage is in reserve to back those up, if you will. Okay, so by the Fed creating more reserves, it's now possible for the commercial banks to then lend more money to their customers because now they have a bigger base of reserves on which to pyramid a larger volume of outstanding customer checking account balances. Okay, and again, that was standard textbook stuff that you would teach. So again, you'd say if the Fed wants to create easier money, if they want to, you know, stimulate the economy, they buy assets that creates more reserves that allows banks to lend more. And so what does that do? It pushes down interest rates, right? Because now, other things equal, the banks have more loans that they want to make. And so the interest rate drops. And also the specific interest rate that the Fed usually targets, it's called the federal funds rate. What that is specifically is the overnight rate that banks charge each other to lend reserves, right? So if a particular bank is aggressive and makes a bunch of loans to its customers and then realizes, uh-oh, we're actually short. We're supposed to have, whatever, $800 million in reserve balances, and we've only got $780 million, so we need to go borrow $20 million in reserves right away. They can go to other commercial banks and say, hey, can we borrow some of your reserves to shore up our reserve requirement? And the other banks will say, of course, but it'll cost you, right? So they charge each other interest to lend reserves. So a bank that has more reserves than it needs can lend those reserves to another bank, okay? And so the federal funds rate, that's the rate typically that's quoted in the press when they say the Fed, you know, did such and such with interest rates today. Usually they're talking about the Fed funds rate. That's what they're talking about. And so generally speaking, if the Fed funds rate goes up, then that means all interest rates tend to shift up also, and vice versa. If the Fed funds rate comes down, if banks can get reserves at a lower rate, percentage rate, then they would be willing, generally speaking, to lend out to their own customers at a lower rate, you know, just because it's just the spread. Okay, I'm going through a lot of material here, obviously, but I'm just trying to get the essence of what's going on so you get what happened in the fall of 2008. Okay, so in the fall of 2008... the Fed wanted to prop up the prices of particular assets, namely mortgage-backed securities, to try to stop this collapse among hedge funds and, you know, Wall Street generally, of these people who had been dabbling in the housing market and they'd been making big profits during the housing bubble years, but now it's all imploding. And so the Fed comes in and wants to buy these assets in order to stop their price from collapsing, or to stabilize it, they, you know, would say is a euphemism. Okay, so to do that, they have to create money. They create reserve balances. So now the commercial banks all of a sudden have a huge increase in the reserve balances. And so normally you would expect that to push down interest rates, right? In particular, the federal funds rate, like the Fed's target rate. If the Fed creates a bunch of new reserves, the supply of reserves goes way up. You think banks would be willing then on the margin to lend reserves out for less interest, a lower interest rate, because they got more of it, you know, they're flooded with reserves. Why not? But the Fed didn't want that at that point. The Fed was still concerned about price inflation because oil prices, people forget this now, oil prices were breaking records earlier that summer. Oil was, you know, over $100 a barrel. And so the Fed didn't want interest rates to drop too low because they were afraid that that would stoke price inflation. Or at least this is the story. And so what the Fed did then, they wanted to decouple those two things. The Fed wanted on the one hand to be able to set interest rate targets and enforce them. And it wanted over here to be able to buy and sell assets in order to stabilize asset prices in particular markets, namely mortgage-backed securities. So how can you do that? Because again, the standard textbook says when the Fed wants to lower interest rates, it buys a bunch of assets, and that naturally pushes down interest rates. So how is it going to be if the Fed doesn't want interest rates to go down, but it doesn't want to create a bunch of new money and go buy assets? What's it going to do? That's why it accelerated this program that had already been authorized, but it hadn't been implemented yet. The Fed got permission to accelerate it and implement it in October of 2008 ahead of schedule. And that program was to start paying interest on reserve balances. So here now, what happened is the Fed said to the commercial banks, okay, you've got your reserves parked with us, right? You have a checking account balance, like Citibank or whatever, has a checking account balance with us, the Fed, and you've got money in it. So normally, if a commercial bank wants to make a loan to a business owner or somebody wants to buy a house, so they need a mortgage, and they borrow money from the bank, when that person goes and writes checks with that newly lent money, when that check gets deposited somewhere, well, there's a clearinghouse operation, and you know, the bank that issued the loan now, when somebody writes a check on that and it gets deposited and it gets presented to the bank in terms of the internal clearinghouse operations, its reserve balances get transferred to that other bank, right? So somebody applies for a mortgage at Citibank. Citibank grants them the $300,000 mortgage. So the person goes and buys it. So ultimately, it's like there's a check that's being written for $300,000 on the Citibank customer's checking account to the seller of the house's checking account. And maybe the seller of the house, you know, banks with Bank of America. So now Citibank's reserve balances with the Fed go down by 300,000 and go up in Bank of America by 300,000. And the same thing with the, you know, their individual customers also. Okay. So the idea is commercial banks, when they make loans to their customers, if the customers go out and spend the money, ultimately that comes back, the chickens come home to roost, and the commercial bank ends up having its own reserve balances with the Fed drawn down, and they get transferred to some other bank. They don't leave the system if it's just private people buying and selling from each other, but any individual bank can't hang on to its reserve balances. They get transferred away to some other bank. So from the Fed's point of view, it's like it takes it down from one account holder's account and transfers it to a different account holder's account. Okay, where does that leave us? The Fed in October 2008 was telling bankers, commercial banks, hey, we will start paying you interest directly. This is something they hadn't done before. Before, if a commercial bank kept its reserves parked at the Fed, it didn't earn any interest. And so that's why typically, and this is why economics textbooks kind of just assume this would happen automatically, even though as the crisis, post-crisis years showed us, it's not something that happens automatically, that commercial banks, if they have excess reserves, if they have reserves parked at the Fed that are in excess of what they need to satisfy their legal reserve requirements, they would go find somebody to lend money to because they can earn interest. You know, when commercial banks lend money to somebody in the private sector, they can charge them interest. So that's why they want to do it. I mean, they got to, you know, make sure they're credit worthy and whatever, but that's how the banks make money, is earning interest on loans. So before the fall of 2008, the commercial banks didn't make money directly from leaving reserves parked at the Fed. Now in October of 2008, the Fed started paying them directly, saying, if you leave reserve balances parked with us, we will pay you interest. So again, this is a new policy. And so why did the Fed do that? The official rationale, like I say, was to divorce those two components of its strategy. It wanted to be able to keep creating new money, flooding the financial sector with new reserves as it bought more and more assets, but it didn't want that to necessarily push down interest rates. And so that's what the Fed's rationale at the time was. It said, we want to be able to put a floor under interest rates so that, you know, our interest rate policy is no longer directly tied to our reserve policy or our asset policy or our balance sheet policy, depending on how they described it. Okay, so that was the idea. And in the beginning, it was fairly innocuous. It was like 25 basis points, which is 0.25%. So it didn't seem like a big deal. When the Fed finally started raising interest rates again, so that was 7 full years after it hit rock bottom. So I think it was in December 2015 is when the Fed started raising interest rates. At that time, again, it was like the mirror image. It did not do the textbook play. The textbook play, when the central bank is supposed to raise interest rates and tighten, is you say, oh, the Fed, when it wants to tighten and raise interest rates, it sells off assets. And so then everything is the mirror image of what we talked about at the beginning of this episode. When the Fed sells assets, let's say the Fed sells $5 billion worth of treasuries to somebody in the private sector. So there what happens is someone in the private sector writes a check for $5 billion and the Fed gets it. So the Fed hands over $5 billion worth of assets, deposits the check or presents the check to that customer's commercial bank. And then ultimately through the clearinghouse operation, so if that customer happens to bank with Citibank, now Citibank says to that hedge fund customer, your account with us just went down by $5 billion, but also Citibank's reserves with the Fed just went down by $5 billion, right? So Citibank, it's a wash from Citibank's perspective. Its client now has $5 billion less in his own checking account with Citibank, but Citibank now on its asset side also has $5 billion less in reserve on deposit with the Fed, okay? But that means the total reserves in the whole system just went down by $5 billion because it's not that somebody else's reserve balance went up by $5 billion. So just when the Fed buys assets, there's a genuine sense in which it creates money out of thin air. On the flip side, when the Fed sells assets, there's a genuine sense in which it destroys money electronically. But it's, you know, this is not like just mere metaphorical language. Just there's a very legitimate sense in which this is true. Okay, so that's the textbook way that the central bank is going to tighten. It sells off assets, sucks reserves out of the system, and now because the banking system as a whole has fewer total reserves to play with, on the margin they become more scarce, and so the price of borrowing reserves even overnight goes up, and that's what the federal funds interest rate target is, or interest rate is. And so if the Fed's target for the interest rate goes up, the way the Fed can achieve that is to suck reserves out of the system. And so that, you know, tightens credit markets, makes interest rates go up, other things equal. Okay, so you might think that, oh, so back in December of 2015, when the Fed started raising interest rates, it started selling off assets, right? No, that's not right. What the Fed did is it just kept raising the rate that it paid commercial banks. It raised the interest payment on reserve balances. So the Fed did not start selling off assets at that point. At some point, I think this really kicked in the beginning of 2018, the Fed also started actually significantly selling off assets. Okay, but my point is the Fed began raising interest rates well before it started selling off assets. So remember, this is a critical thing. What the Fed did in the fall of 2008 gave it the flexibility to tinker with interest rates but not necessarily have that dovetail or correspond to what it was doing with its own collection of assets or its balance sheet, if you know that terminology. And so why did they do that? I told you why on the front end. Now on the back end, why did the Fed choose to start raising interest rates not by selling off assets and sucking out reserves, but instead by just raising the rate that it pays banks? Because they were afraid, or the official rationale was, they said, well, right now we're just sitting on a lot of treasury debt and mortgage-backed securities. And if we just start selling those off, we might crash the housing market, or we might cause a spike in treasury yields, and that might, you know, cause financing problems for the U.S. government. And so the Fed did not want to start just have a massive fire sale of the assets it had accumulated. To give you an idea, by the way, of how much did the Fed buy, going into the financial crisis in 2008, the Fed had roughly $850 billion of total assets. And then through the various rounds of what's called QE or quantitative easing, it ultimately ended up holding about $4.5 trillion of assets. Okay, so jumping from about $850 billion and going into the fall of 2008 up until when the so-called taper happened, I think that was like in the fall of 2014, that's when the Fed started just treading water, and that was, the Fed had about $4.5 trillion of assets then. Okay, so those were the official Fed, you know, the Fed's rationale for what it was doing. And so now I just want to underscore, though, what that means, that the Fed has been paying banks to not make loans to their customers. Because again, the commercial banks, they get flooded with liquidity. They have all these reserves that are created when the Fed buys treasury debt mortgage-backed securities. As the Fed inflated its own balance sheet, it flooded the markets with reserve balances. And so it didn't want, well, the official rationale was it wanted to bottle that up. And this is also a thing when people try to explain, gee, how come prices didn't explode? This is one of the factors that's certainly involved. The Fed is directly paying banks to not make loans. And so how is the Fed raising interest rates without selling off assets? Because it just keeps raising the interest rate it pays the commercial banks. So if you're a commercial bank and the Fed's paying, let's say, 1.6% for you to keep your reserves parked at the Fed, you would be stupid to make loans to any of your customers for less than 1.6% because the Fed can guarantee it. The Fed can't run out of money. It can just create it. So you know you're getting paid what the Fed promised. I mean, I guess they could just screw you and say we decided to change policy and people would be mad, but there's no financial reason. The Fed's not going to have a bad quarter and not be able to pay you. They can just create money. I'm speaking loosely, but you get the idea. Having the Fed say, we'll pay you if you keep your money parked with us is a lot safer than even a very reputable company saying, oh, we'll pay you a certain interest rate if you make a loan to us, because that company, its sales could collapse, whatever. There could be a lawsuit, who knows? All right, so that's the way the Fed was raising interest rates, was just by raising the amount it was paying the banks. So like I said, in the beginning, it was fairly innocuous. But as that interest rate on reserve balances kept rising, we're talking serious money because the reserve balances themselves had gotten to be astronomical given all of the asset purchases and reserve creation that the Fed had engaged in. So at the peak, excess reserve balances were at $2.7 trillion back in August of 2014. I mean, these are ballpark figures, and I'm just looking at the chart, eyeballing it, but that's roughly correct. That excess reserves mean the banking system as a whole, the commercial banking system, how many reserves that they have over and above the legal minimum they needed for the reserve requirement. They had about $2.7 trillion in excess reserves back in August 2014. Since then, that has steadily come down as the Fed has been getting rid of assets. So right now, the excess reserve balances are about $1.6 trillion. You throw in the required reserve balances, and right now, total reserves as of December 12th, 2018, that's the latest data that I have access to, are about $1.7 trillion. Okay? So those are the balances on which the Federal Reserve is paying commercial banks. And now with the latest announcement that Powell, the Fed just made in here in December of 2018, they're paying commercial banks 2.4% interest on reserve balances. So you just multiply those together. There's $1.7 trillion right now in outstanding reserve balances. And the Fed is telling commercial banks right now, we're paying you 2.4% on that. You multiply those together, that's $40.8 billion a year of just interest that the Fed now is paying commercial banks. So you say, well, is that real money? What does that mean? Well, there's a sense in which you could say the taxpayers are paying it. And this would be my final point. The way the system is set up, the Federal Reserve earns interest on the assets that it buys. So the Fed creates money, in a sense, goes and buys assets, and then hopefully those assets yield income. And so now the Fed earns income, right, because it's got a bunch of assets that pay interest. And so now the Fed, Fed's got all this income to report. The Fed has expenses, they got lights, they got to clean the floors, they got to buy toilet paper, and they got a bunch of economists on staff to, do research reports and who knows what they do. Can bamboozle the public. And of course, the Fed has shareholders. We've talked about this. The actual commercial banks own the Fed, literally. And they have, they have to make payments to them. But those are all sort of like locked in. It's not that the shareholders get whatever is left over. The residual claimant on the Fed's earnings is the U.S. Treasury. And so at the end of the accounting period, the Fed remits its excess earnings to the U.S. Treasury. So the Fed was giving historically very large payments to the Treasury in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis because the Fed's assets, I told you, ballooned from 800 and some billion up to $4.5 trillion. So they were earning a significant flow of interest income off of those assets. And then after paying their bills and their normal expenses, the Fed then would turn that over to the U.S. Treasury. So you can see this symbiotic relationship, and you can get a better understanding of why would the government give such a lucrative opportunity to this private or quasi-private institution? Well, because the U.S. government benefits too from this operation. They have this ready buyer in the secondary market of its debt, and the interest that's paid, the Fed, most of it just hands it right back. So in a sense, it's like an interest-free loan, if you think of it that way. But I'm sort of going far afield here, just coming back to the Fed has lower excess earnings if, in addition to all of its other expenses, it's got to pay the lights, it's got to pay the guy to mow the lawn, it's got to pay all the top flight economists to write up research papers saying how great the Fed is and how it saved the world. In addition to that, now, as of this recording, the Fed is at an annual rate paying commercial banks $40.8 billion. So of all the revenue flowing into the Fed from its assets and the income they generate, $40.8 billion of it now has to get paid out as an expense owed to the commercial banks. So that's $40.8 billion less that the taxpayers ultimately have. Okay, so that's it in a nutshell. That's a good logical stopping point. But the big picture is, just as the government was telling average people we need to bail out Wall Street in order to keep credit flowing to Main Street, the Federal Reserve literally began paying banks to not make loans to their customers. That's not how they described it, but that's one way of explaining what they did. And now, as the Fed continues to raise interest rates, that is effectively increasing how much of the Fed's earnings get diverted to the commercial banks. As of this recording, at an annual rate, the Fed is paying the commercial banks just shy of $41 billion on an annual basis to keep this system afloat. And I submit that if the Fed has just proposed that as a standalone policy, like, you know what, we think in this troubling time and as we go into the Great Recession, we're just going to start paying banks, I think people would have been setting cars on fire. But because this is such a mysterious, difficult, complex topic, most people don't even really get what's going on. Beyond the immorality and the chicanery and all the other adjectives you want to use here, or I guess nouns, the another problem is just how the Fed has painted itself into a corner. That notice, I think this is one reason that the Fed had to start letting its balance sheet shrink, is because they realized if we start raising interest rates, as the percentage that we're multiplying the outstanding reserve balances by, if we keep raising that percentage, namely the interest rate, that's just going to eventually eat up all of our income. You know, then the Fed would be losing money. And so I think they were under pressure for other reasons as well. But this is one of the reasons that the Fed did have to start letting its actual holdings of assets start shrinking as well. So like I said, it was two different things. The Fed first started raising interest rates, and then only later, actually, as its assets were maturing, it started letting some of them roll off. So in other words, the total holdings of the Fed began shrinking. So they no longer hold as many assets as they used to. And again, I think those two are related, that the Fed was realizing we can't just keep carrying $4.5 trillion of assets, because if we do, that means we've got this huge mass of outstanding reserves in the system that we can't just keep paying interest on as we raise the interest rate. So there you have it. Now you understand what I mean when I tell crowds, hey, guess what? Back when the financial crisis hit, the Fed instituted a new policy to start paying banks to not make loans to their customers. And now you know the rest of the story. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'll have some links at bobmurphyshow.com/10 if you want to hear more. And you know what? I'm not going to insert a little ad. Let me just say it right now. If you want to get a nice little read, something that's suitable for some kids. By the way, I didn't say this before. I'm not just saying this to try to trick you into getting it because now you're dying of curiosity. The Three Lads and the Lizard King, the story I wrote for my son, I'm not kidding. Preview that before you let some six-year-old look at it, because there's something in there that you'll know what I'm talking about when you read it. And, you know, most parents, I think, think, oh, yeah, that's fine. But I do want to give you a heads up. You should read it first before you let little Timmy or Sarah check it out. And that's at bobmurphyshow.com/lizard. Thanks for your attention, folks, and we'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.